Another update at 4. Stay tuned now for Indie Media On Air. All right, welcome to Indie Media On Air. I'm Chris Burnett, and today we have yet another fabulous show for you. But first, a few items in the news. As many of you know, there was probably the largest protest against the Sensenbrenner bill in Los Angeles on Saturday. Over 500,000 people filled the streets of downtown Los Angeles. City officials are saying it's the largest demonstration they've ever seen. Both the mayor and the chief of police attended the demonstration and voiced opposition to the proposed anti-immigrant law, which is to be debated in the Senate next week. And today, there was an article in the LA Times that a friend of mine pointed out to me, another journalist. Thank you for that, actually. That basically, the FBI considers indie media and Food Not Bombs to be worthy of being on a terrorist watch list. That's right. People like me and indie media and other media activists who report the news and do it our own way end up on terrorist watch lists. And Food Not Bombs, of course, that feeds poor people with vegetarian food, is a suspect as well. Food Not Bombs, if you don't know, is an all-volunteer organization that recovers food that would otherwise be thrown out and serves vegetarian meals to the public at no cost. The story actually originally broke, as far as I know, in Austin when an FBI agent gave a presentation at the University of Texas School of Law last Wednesday. And a student who was in the classroom was obviously shocked and decided to make this very public and request the list that was presented to the class, which is still an issue at this moment. There's a Freedom of Information Act request for that. Anyways, Austin Indie Media was posted a very good story and sort of background on this, which I recommend that everybody go to. Austin.indiemedia.org. And for those of you who don't know, Austin Indie Media is from their site, is a newswire in which readers may publish news, events, and commentary. And I thought I would just read the editor's note from Austin Indie Media Collective. The Austin Indie Media Collective would like to assure our readers that while we do provide resources for people to become the media and thereby greatly challenge the information produced both by governments and corporate media, we do not hate freedom, as the FBI is now essentially claiming. We feel that providing resources for people to participate in the creation and sharing of information, and at the same time providing a forum for deliberation on the information presented, we are fostering behavior necessary for a functional democracy. In fact, we view the popular production of information as a basic tenet of a truly democratic society. We deeply regret that the FBI publicly makes such outrageous claims, and we would like to point the reader to the FBI's own very well-documented support and perpetration of domestic terrorism, in which they give a number of links to the history of COINTELPRO. And for readers or listeners who don't know about COINTELPRO, you can read up on some of the links provided at austin.indiemedia.org. The story is, in a guest lecture at the University of Texas School of Law on Wednesday, this was from the site, FBI supervisor, senior resident agent G. Charles Rasner listed Indie Media, Food Not Bombs, and the Communist Party of Texas as terrorist watch cause groups in Austin. Rasner gave a presentation entitled Counterterrorism Efforts in Texas to a U.S. Law and National Security class at the law school. He used a PowerPoint slide to illustrate the nature of the terrorist threat in Central Texas. The word unclassified appeared prominently in bold red letters on the opening PowerPoint slide. Now, I suspect that if indie media from Central Texas is on this list, wouldn't be surprised if the FBI is listening to today's show. And in which case, I hope that they are, because we have a very special guest that we're going to be talking to shortly. His name is David Ray Griffin, and he is Emeritus Professor of Philosophy of Religion and Theology, Claremont School of Theology and Claremont Graduate University, author or editor of some 30 books, including The New Pearl Harbor, and the 911 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. And basically, we're going to be talking about David's conclusions from a paper he wrote that everybody can find at st911.org. That's S as in Sam, T as in Tom, 911.org. His conclusions are fairly remarkable, and he actually says that the events of September 11th were perpetrated by domestic terrorists and not by the official conspiracy theory that Al-Qaeda had something to do with it. And so if the FBI is listening today, maybe you could take a tip from Griffin and follow up on some of the conclusions and evidence that the people at st911.org are presenting and investigate that. And a number of people are beginning to, at least in, you know, citizens and groups such as Scholars for 911 Truth. So that might be far more worthy of investigation than some people who make media and serve poor people food. So we're going to be right back with David Ray Griffin, and stay tuned. All right, welcome back. So we're going to be speaking with David Ray Griffin, Emeritus Professor of Philosophy and Religion and Theology, Claremont School of Theology and Claremont Graduate University. And before we get started, I am just going to read the conclusion of the paper that David wrote that you can find at st911.org. He says, "It is, in any case, already possible to know, beyond a reasonable doubt, one very important thing. The destruction of the World Trade Center was an inside job, orchestrated by domestic terrorists. Foreign terrorists could not have gotten access to the buildings to plant the explosives. They probably would not have had the courtesy to make sure that the buildings collapsed straight down rather than falling over onto surrounding buildings. And they could not have orchestrated a cover-up from the quick disposal of the steel to the FEMA report to the 911 Commission." Continuing, "The evidence for this conclusion has thus far been largely ignored by the mainstream press. Perhaps under the guise of obeying President Bush's advice not to tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories. We have seen, however, that it is the Bush administration's conspiracy theory that is the outrageous one, because it is violently contradicted by numerous facts, including some basic laws of physics." And David asks the question is why would the mainstream press avoid this, and offers some suggestions, which that the implications are indeed disturbing. Many people who know or at least suspect the truth about 911 probably believe that revealing it would be so disturbing to the American psyche, the American form of government, and global stability, that it is better to pretend to believe the official version. I would suggest, however, that any merit this argument may have had earlier has been overcome by more recent events and realizations. Far more devastating to the American psyche, the American form of government, and the world as a whole will be the continued rule of those who brought us 911, because the values reflected in that horrendous event have reflected in the Bush administration's lies to justify the attack on Iraq, its disregard for environmental science and the Bill of Rights, its criminal negligence before and after Katrina, and now its apparent plan not only to weaponize space but also to authorize the use of nuclear weapons in a preemptive strike." And that's a pretty heavy conclusion to the paper. And I would like to welcome David Ray Griffin to the show. David, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
Well, I'd just like to start off by asking you maybe to give us an update on where your work is at and what's going on with Scholars for 911 Truth.
Well, the development of the Scholars for 911 Truth is a great thing, I think, because for so long the mainstream media and people in the government could dismiss the 911 Truth movement as a bunch of crazies on the internet, or a bunch of crazies on the internet and this theologian. And now when you go on the website, you see there are, about 60 full members. This means people with PhDs. I believe all of them have PhDs. At least they've qualified for full membership, then there are associate members and others. So that kind of put-down can't be made anymore, or at least it should be ruled out. Now, we've seen with Charlie Sheen's statement that the powers that be and those who want to defend the official story still refuse to confront any criticism on its merits. They simply attack the person. And they'll do the same thing with us, too, but with, you know, philosophers of science and physicists and theologians and architects and engineers, it's a little harder to dismiss all these people as conspiracy nuts. So that's a very important development that has occurred. In my own work, I have decided that if we're really going to have any kind of major mass movement and pressure in this country for change, which includes, of course, exposing the truth about 9/11, but also includes recognizing and then rejecting the global domination project that 9/11 was engineered to further, to have the kind of turnaround that we need, it will probably have to be another religious movement like the civil rights movement was and abolition movement was and the anti-nuclear movement at one stage was, and so on. So I've been focusing, as in my Madison talk, I focused it on what religious people should do about this, focusing on what all the major religions and ethical systems have in common in terms of moral values that are diametrically opposed to the moral values involved in the American empire. But more recently now, I'm focusing on my own religious tradition, in particular the Christian tradition. So I have a new book coming out that's probably going to be called Christian Faith and the Truth Behind 9/11. So I'll be focusing to a great extent on trying to get the churches now involved, while at the same time I'm hoping that my Jewish and Muslim colleagues are doing the same thing in their communities, which in fact they are.
Well, that brings up a couple more questions that I want to follow up with, which is, what has been the response of the religious community to this kind of information and you know, the very stark conclusions that you're drawing in your papers and books?
Well, unfortunately, thus far, it's been very slow. Now, there is a growing awareness of the problem and a willingness to speak out. So, for example, Kevin Barrett, a Muslim, the one who had invited me to Madison, John Cobb, a theologian, my own former professor, in fact, and Sandra Labarsky, a Jewish theologian, are editing a book called 9/11 in the American Empire, Christian Jews and Muslims Speak Out. So we're hoping that through this volume and related efforts that this movement will grow in all three, at least, of the Abrahamic traditions. Of course, we'll be very excited to have Hindus and Buddhists and others involved, too.
And what about the mainstream press? Has there been more stories being published? Is it actually getting out there? And besides, on websites?
Well, not very, you know, there certainly hasn't been any big rush thus far, but there have been a few signs that things may be changing. A few months ago, the LA Times magazine, the Sunday magazine, published a favorable interview with me. Likewise, a major reporter with a major newspaper has interviewed me. The interview has not been printed yet. This reporter got very involved with Katrina and Rita and all the other big stories that have been occurring in the last few months and just hasn't had time. But this reporter just contacted me and said he's hoping to get back on this and finish it up. And I think it's to be a favorable or at least neutral account, not a dismissing account. And then, of course, the Charlie Sheen phenomenon here. We don't know yet what kind of reverberations that will have, but obviously showbiz was able to didn't get stomped on immediately by the higher powers in CNN, and they were able to continue a second and a third night with that same theme. And in fact, they put on Mike Berger, who's a great spokesman from 9/11truth.org, and I don't know if you saw it, but he made within the about 5 minutes he had, he gave a great summary of some of the main problems in the official theory and pointed out that whatever people say about Charlie Sheen's personal life, he's done his homework with regard to this issue, and that's what people should be addressing.
Right. Well, the response is predictable, right? He's actors are not supposed to talk about things. They're supposed to act.
It's okay if they talk about him from the point of view of Charlton Heston, or it's only liberal actors that aren't supposed to talk about such things.
Or critical. I think it's really going to be valuable for us to touch upon some of the details in your paper, because really that's where the evidence is, and that's where we can draw some hypotheses and theories about what actually happened. And before I do that, I want to read the implications part from your paper to give people a sort of context for maybe what we can talk about, which is what happened in August with the release of the testimonials. You say, the official theory about the collapse of the towers, I have suggested, is rendered extremely implausible by two main facts. First, aside from the alleged exception of 911, steel frame high-rise buildings have never been caused to collapse by fire. All such collapses have all been produced by carefully placed explosives. Second, the collapse of the Twin Towers manifested at least 11 characteristics, features of controlled demolitions. The probability that any of these features would occur in the absence of explosives is extremely low. The probability that all 11 of them would occur is essentially zero. And you continue, we can say, therefore, that the official theory about the towers is disproved about as thoroughly as such a theory possibly could be, where all the evidence can be explained by the alternative theory, according to which the towers were brought down by explosives. The official theory is, accordingly, an outrageous theory, whereas the alternative theory is, from a scientific point of view, the only reasonable theory available. Now, what were some of the testimonials why were those so significant?
Let me come to those, but let me just elaborate on what you just read.
Okay.
So many people, like with what Charlie said about these things, they just react emotionally and say, oh, you know, explosives in the buildings, that's just outrageous, that's just ridiculous. But that's going from the point of view that, of course, our government is basically good. We make some mistakes, but we would never do anything deliberately evil, certainly nothing of this scale. In the first place, if one knows something about the history of warfare and warfare by the United States, and how many times we have produced false flag incidents or otherwise lied about incidents or provoked incidents in order to start a war, maybe people would be a little less certain that our government wouldn't do such a thing. But in any case, finally, if this is going to be a rational discussion, then the we have to look at the evidence. We can't just say they wouldn't do such a thing. You have to look at the facts. And once you look at the facts, I say it is very clear that the official theory, according to which the buildings came down primarily because of fires, with the towers because of fires and the impact of the airplanes, that is just absurd, because there are all these characteristics that are typically produced by the kind of controlled demolition that is called implosion. And so there they all are. And, you know, just looking at it, as you say, never before 9/11, never after 9/11, have steel frame high-rises collapsed for any other reason other than explosives in this process known as controlled demolition. So the natural assumption would be that that's what happened here. So far from being outrageous, it's what should be expected. And anybody who wants to claim otherwise, the burden of proof is on them to say, well, so there was something special about these buildings or something special about these fires that could mimic the kind of collapse that usually can be produced only by carefully planned, very precisely placed explosives. And in fact, if you go on implosionworld.com, you'll find that there are only a few countries in the companies in the world, demolition companies, that are capable of doing this kind of implosion. So the idea that it could have just come about accidentally because an airplane hit the buildings and then they had some fires is just absurd.
Well, okay, so then let's move on to the testimonials and some of the 11 points. I mean, you in your paper you say there are these 11 characteristics that are present during the events, and each of them are representative or fall within the framework of a theory that suggests controlled demolition.
Yeah, okay, let's take one of them is simply sudden onset. That if you look at the videos on that you can see on the internet, the collapses, you see the buildings are perfectly still. They're, you know, the towers are not still shaking from the impact of the airplanes or anything like that. And if fire had caused something to happen, the it would have gradually heated up the steel, and then the steel would have started to sag. You don't see any sagging whatsoever. You see a completely motionless building in all three cases. And then just suddenly, it just collapses. Secondly, it collapses essentially straight down. Now, another kind of controlled demolition is the topple over type. And that's much easier to do, and lots of companies can do that. But if that had been done with particularly the towers, 110 stories, think of the devastation that would have been created in Lower Manhattan if these buildings had fallen over horizontally. And that's why I made the point that we can't expect that Al-Qaeda terrorists who hated Americans and wanted to kill as many as possible would have had the courtesy to bring the building straight down, even if they had had the capability.
Well, and it's an art of to actually make that happen.
Yeah, anybody can go on and read an interview with Mark Loiseau, who is the president of Controlled Demolition, Inc., which actually did the cleanup for the World Trade Center. And he explains in an interview with New Scientist magazine that, how carefully he has to plan to do any kind of controlled demolition like this, particularly an implosion. A third characteristic is that they come down at virtually free fall speed. Now, there's just no way, even if you said, okay, somehow I believe that fire brought these buildings down, there's no way you can give an explanation of how they could come down at virtually free fall speed. In other words, if you had been on the top of the building, the World Trade Center, one of the towers, and thrown a brick off just as the building began to collapse, the brick would have reached the ground only slightly before the whole tower did. That's virtually free fall speed. And you can see that by looking at the collapses on the internet. You can see, because in the case of the towers, there were these huge explosions which blew aluminum and even steel out sideways several hundred feet. And that's why I stress that the collapse is essentially straight down, but that doesn't mean it, in the case of the towers, it came down right into the footprint. But still, they came basically straight down. And if you look at that, then you see that the things that are outside the profile of the building are falling at about the same speed as the things inside the profile. And that means the things inside the profile, the upper floors, are not encountering any resistance from the lower floors, even though those lower floors consisted of concrete and steel attached to enormous steel columns, 47 core columns, and then over a couple hundred columns around the perimeter. And so the idea that these upper floors were encountering no resistance, there's no way to explain that except by explosives, and that's exactly what explosives are. You have thermite or thermate or some other RDX or some other common explosives, and what they do is slice the steel in various fairly short pieces, and so the whole building collapses.
Let me just interrupt you here real quick, David. You are listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, streaming live on the net at kpfk.org. I'm Chris Burnett. This show is Indie Media On Air, and I am speaking with David Ray Griffin. Continuing, David, you actually quote Dave Heller, a builder with a degree in physics and architecture, saying that the building could not have been pancaking because it fell too quickly.
That's right. And Stephen Jones, who is a physicist, has made the same point, saying that, this is one of the basic laws of physics, that if a falling object encounters something, it's going to slow down. So the pancake theory, which was the one that the 9/11 Commission report endorsed, it's been rejected now by the later report that the National Institute of Standards and Technology put out. But still, that's the one that many people believe, because very few people have gone on to read the NIST report, but a lot of people have the 9/11 Commission report. And this is the idea that the floors right above the hole that was created by each airplane broke loose because of the hole and the weight of the floors above that, broke loose and fell down on the floor below, therefore knocking that floor loose from its connectors to the core columns and the perimeter columns, and then they went down to the next floor, and then it had pancaked all the way down. Well, one problem with that is, if that had been the case, at least the core columns, the 47 core columns, would still have been sticking about 1,000 feet up in the air. And yet what we got were total collapses into piles of rubble no more than a few stories high.
And total collapse is one of the 11 points.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. That's another one that none of the so-called official theories can explain. But then this point is that if you had had pancaking down, you could have watched it on the Internet, and each time the floor above hit a floor below, there would be a slight little delay. This is one of the basic laws of physics, Jones stresses. And you certainly couldn't have, had the whole thing collapse in about 10 seconds. And then Building 7 collapses in less than 7 seconds. Of course, it's only 47 stories high, but again, at essentially free fall speed. and for people who think, well, somehow the impact of the airplanes destabilized the buildings, and somehow that produced this miraculous mimicking of controlled implosion. Just recall that Building 7 was not hit by an airplane. So you have to explain its collapse wholly in terms of fire. And as you stressed, fire has never in the history of our world ever brought down a steel frame high-rise building. And of course, I say you have to remember about Building 7 because none of the people who put out the official reports want you to think about Building 7. And this is why Charlie Sheen is absolutely right to say, think about Building 7. It's the crux, because it's the one that most obviously cannot be explained by the official theory. And if the theory about Building 7 is false, then we can infer that the whole story is false.
It was one of the videos that I saw when I saw WTC-7 coming down. It was just blatantly obvious that, you know, something else was going on there because of the speed and because of the total collapse, simultaneous collapse.
Yeah, and that's the other point there, that to have this straight down collapse, this would mean that all of the steel columns, these massive steel columns, would have had to have been heated up at exactly the same temperature at the same time. And you realize that is preposterous because, first of all, the fires were not very hot. Secondly, you know, they weren't very big compared with fires in buildings that have not collapsed. They certainly were not very long-lasting. The fire in the South Tower was 56 minutes. And yet buildings like the L.A. Fire several years ago burnt for about, 17 hours. And same with the Philadelphia fire and one in Caracas. And I guess the L.A. fire wasn't quite that long, but still it was much longer than 56 minutes. And none of those buildings collapsed even partially, let alone totally. So you know, think about Building Number 7, which the 9/11 Commission report obviously didn't want you thinking about, because in its 571 pages, it never even mentions the fact that Building 7 collapsed.
And continuing on the list, you talk about sliced steel and you talk about pulverization of concrete and other materials.
Oh, yeah, that one is, like all these others, by itself proves the case, because and this is one respect in which the collapse of the Twin Towers is different from all previous implosions, and also different from Building 7. That is, virtually everything in the building, concrete, desks, computers, everything, was pulverized into very tiny dust particles. Jim Hoffman estimates about 10 microns. In other words, all that was left after the collapse was the steel and this dust. And this has been stated by many people who were at the site.
You quote Colonel John O'Dowd of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
That's right. And so when you think about that, you realize that this makes sense, because the Twin Towers were obviously the tallest buildings that had ever been brought down. They also had the most massive steel columns of any building that's ever been brought down. And so the explosives had to be much stronger, much more powerful, to make sure that all of the steel columns got sliced, and of course they had to be sliced in many different places in order to bring them down in pieces about 20 to 50 feet long, evidently. And so the explosives, to guarantee that all that steel would be sliced, would have been very powerful in comparison with concrete and wood. And so that's what you would expect in this case, that everything would be pulverized, and indeed it was.
There are a couple of areas I do want to focus on, and I want to make sure we have time for. One is the testimonials that sort of support the 11 characteristics that we're talking about here. And maybe you could give a few examples of that. I also, at one point, I want to address the Popular Mechanics article that came out last year trying to debunk a lot of what you're saying and a lot of what other people are saying from st911.org. But let's start off with maybe a few testimonials, and then maybe we can jump back into more of the these characteristics.
Okay, here's one from Fire Chief Frank Crothers, who said, "There was what appeared to be at first an explosion. It appeared at the very top." He's talking about the South Tower. "Simultaneously, from all four sides, material shot out horizontally. Then there seemed to be a momentary delay before you could see the beginning of the collapse." Well, you can see that refutes the official theory, which is when you see things coming out of the sides of the building, that's because the building is pancaking and pushing the air out, which pushes other materials out too. But as he says, it appeared from the very top, whereas the pancaking didn't start till down around the 80th or 90th floor where the planes hit. And so this was happening above that and before any collapse began. You have people who reported hearing the ground shaking, feeling the ground shaking slightly before either the South Tower or the North Tower came down. And this Mark Loiseau that I'm quoting from Controlled Demolition, he has said that if he were going to bring down the World Trade Center, he would start with explosions in the basement to dislodge those steel columns.
I think it's important to provide the sort of the context for these testimonials. They were actually they were fought for. And the New York Times did a FOIA request, and they were released last year in August of 2005. Correct?
That's right. They had been recorded. The outgoing fire commissioner at that time, Thomas Van Essen, had said he wanted the firefighters and the emergency medical workers, who are part of the fire department too, to record their memories before they had been reshaped by the public story. So these were done in December of 2001 and January. And then the New York Times and the families tried to get a hold of them, but the city of New York refused. So they filed a suit, and all the lower courts refused them. But finally, the highest court of New York State of Court of Appeals, said to the city, yes, you must release these. This is public information. So they were released, and they're put on a New York Times website, and I cite this in my paper. If anybody wants to read this paper, it's called Explosive Testimony. If you just Google that, you'll find it all over the place. And you can read these things, and then you can go on and read them for yourself. But here are the kinds of things you see. Firefighter Thomas Torelli, who, referring to the South Tower, said, "It almost sounded like bombs going off, like boom, 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 like seven or eight." So it isn't that people just heard one explosion. They heard seven or eight. Or Craig Carlson, another firefighter, said he heard explosions coming from Building 2. It seemed like it took forever, but there were about 10 explosions before the building started coming down.
I want to invite callers to call into the station if they have any questions or comments for David. The number is 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735. And I think the important thing to emphasize here, David, is that all these people that you're quoting, or most of them, and I'm sure there's many others, but these are firefighters, police, and city officials.
Yeah, and also employees of the... before we had these testimonies from firefighters and medical workers, there were also a lot of testimonies scattered here and there by journalists and policemen and employees in the World Trade Center, and those contained a lot of very impressive testimonials too. Let me give you one of these. Engineer Mike Pecoraro was working down at the sea level in one of the sub-basements, and he said when he came up to that level, there was nothing but rubble. We're talking about a 50-ton hydraulic press gone. Then we went up to the parking garage, but found it was also gone. Then on B level, we found a steel and concrete fire door, which weighed about 300 pounds, but was wrinkled up like a piece of aluminum foil. So how could anybody explain how an airplane hitting the building on the 80th or 90th floor could have caused that kind of effect in the in one of the basements?
And this is, of course, before the collapse.
That's right. Yeah. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
the collapse of the North Tower did not collapse until 102 minutes, whereas the South Tower, even though it was hit second, collapsed first in only 56 minutes. Here's another one from Fire Captain Dennis Tardillo. Speaking of the South Tower, he said, "I hear an explosion and I look up. It is as if the building is being imploded from the top floor down, one after another. Boom, boom, boom."
I should mention to listeners, what we're doing right now is actually going through a lot of what David has written in the paper on st911.org. That's S as in Sam, T as in Tom, 911.org. And in the paper, these testimonials are used to sort of provide the context for the 11 characteristics that are that fit within a theory of controlled demolitions, of the way that the buildings came down. And I think David does a tremendous job at putting this information together in a very cohesive and easy-to-read way. So I really recommend that if you have the time, go there and read this paper. One of the other quotes, David, is from a paramedic named Daniel Rivera. And he says, "It was a friggin' noise. At first I thought it was, do you ever see professional demolition where they set the charges on certain floors and then you hear pop, 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 pop? I thought it was that."
Yeah, that's a good one. And one of my favorites is by firefighter Richard Banasiski. Because one of the one of these characteristics of controlled demolition is what they call demolition rings, where you see explosions going off very rapidly around one floor and sometimes up and down. And he says, "There was an explosion. It seemed like on television when they blow up these buildings. It seemed like it was going all the way around like a belt, all these explosions."
One thing I should note, too, in Stephen Jones's paper, there's a very good link to video of the two buildings that came down. And I think that – is that the one that you referenced earlier on the website?
That's right. Okay. I refer to it. If anybody wants to look at it, I think you can just Google Stephen Jones, and you'll find his paper all over the place. It's called Why Indeed Did the Twin Towers Collapse? Or the Why Indeed Did the World Trade Center Collapse?
And Stephen Jones is the professor of physics at Brigham Young University. I want to go ahead and go to a couple of calls, and I'd like to ask the callers to please keep your questions brief. There's a lot of you, and if you can do that, we'll get to more of you. We'll start off with Nancy in Glendale. Welcome to IndyMedia On Air.
Hi. I would like to thank you very much for having this interview on KPFK. And I will mention that my congressman, Adam Schiff, had public office hours last Saturday in San Gabriel. And I went there, and after I paid him three compliments about votes that he had done that I like, I brought up the 911 issue and all the omissions in the report. And I also gave him a copy of the Los Angeles Times article that was in March 21st that mentioned that that the testimony of the FBI agent at the Zacharias Moussaoui Moussaoui trial. Anyway, of course, my congressman said he did not agree with me on the calling into question the 911 commission report, but he did agree that he had seen that article and things in that LA Times article had concerned him. So I'll end by saying now that I'm public about this with my congressman, I am even more motivated to do more outreach to get the word spread more widely. So thank you for this coverage. Thank you, David Ray Griffin.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nancy, for calling in. And next up is Kay in Los Angeles. Quick question or comment.
Okay. I have three very short things to say or ask. And the first one is, there is a huge phone movement going on to call CNN as a result of Charlie Sheen. There's an enormous amount of calls going in, and so I would just like to encourage everyone to write to CNN to perhaps have David Griffin on a program or as a follow-up that more information is wanted than what Charlie and Alex Jones have said. And by a mass of us call, they're going to have to respond, and that was number one.
Okay. Do you have anything else to ask?
Yeah, I would like to know if you will post all the links that David Ray Griffin is doing on your website, because I'm driving, can't write them down, and everybody can't. Can you post the links on the website?
Yeah, well, what you can do is maybe if you can remember, there's two very easy websites, st911.org. S as in Sam, T as in Tom, 911.org. You can also email me, chris@indymedia.org, if you can remember that. And I can probably send you in the right direction. Kay, we're going to keep moving, and then I'll have David address those real quick, okay?
Thank you.
Thank you for calling in. David, do you have any comments to add to that?
Oh, no, I just support what she said.
Okay, great. We're going to go to the next caller, which is Menno in Whittier. Welcome to Indy Media on Air. Quick question or comment?
Yeah, just so I'm wondering, if there really are FBI agents listening to this program right now, I'm hoping and appealing to their heart that maybe they could start investigating this administration, this Bush administration. You know, just like some of them came up and like went after Nixon when they found a door, you know, taped over, and that started the whole Watergate. You know, because we need to get this administration out. I fully believe they're involved with 911, and that it actually even goes beyond them. So I'm just hoping if there's some like so-called honest cops out there, they need to, you know, follow up the real domestic terrorists, and it starts in the White House. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's a good comment. There are lots of FBI agents who, of course, know the truth about what went on, but they're one might say strongly encouraged to keep their mouths shut. Under penalty of imprisonment or worse.
Have you talked to any of them yourself?
I have not, but in my first book, well, in both books, I've mentioned several who have said that they were clamped down on and they've been gagged. And of course, Sabelle Edmonds is the most famous of these, but there are several others who have stories to tell that they're not allowed to tell. And I have a lot of sympathy for that. You know, if people have families, they can't give up their income. They don't want to go to prison the rest of their lives. But on the other hand, the situation facing us is so huge and so dangerous, not only for our own future as a country, but the future of the world, that I would hope there would be somebody or a few who do know what was going on and will come forward, find some news outlet that will broadcast what they say before they can get silenced. And because until, you know, you can have people like me and Stephen Jones and Charlie Sheen and the 60 full members of Scholars for Truth and on saying that this is an inside job brought about to further the American empire. But it doesn't really grab people. It doesn't really provide convincing evidence from most people's point of view unless somebody on the inside says, look, I was part of this, and I kept my mouth shut till now, but here's the truth of what happened. And one or two of those could make a huge difference. So I hope there's somebody who maybe doesn't have a family who's dependent upon them who could show this kind of courage.
David, one question that I find that is something that needs to be addressed is the fact that there was a lot of reports about investigations of Al-Qaeda members in this country. And, you know, a lot of it I'd hear about, but I don't know much of the details about, but which suggests that everything that we've been talking about is, you know, can't possibly be the case when the FBI was actually following these people who were engaged in this alleged plot.
Yeah, and this is, you know, I do have a whole chapter on this in each of my books. You know, where was did the FBI FBI headquarters deliberately squelch several investigations that might have revealed what was going on ahead of time, or revealed the true perpetrators afterwards? And there is a tremendous amount of evidence that that did occur. And those are some of the FBI agents, the field agents who wanted to pursue these leads that I'm talking about. But having said that, I must also add, we don't really know what's going on, because what we have here is a false flag operation in which it's made to look like it was perpetrated by someone other than the true perpetrators. In this case, it was made to appear to be the work of Arab Muslims. And so we don't know how much all of this about these guys going around and going to flight school and getting passports easily and all of this, whether that's all simply part of the cover story, which people are supposed to uncover and say, oh, look, government, you could have done this, and you were incompetent. You know, incompetence doesn't send you to prison or the gas chamber. So I don't know what the role of these Al-Qaeda members was, to what extent. I mean, clearly they were patsies, but to what extent they were willing patsies who had some idea of what was going on, so I don't know.
Right. Well, we're going to go to another caller. Roger in Silver Lake, welcome to Indie Media On Air.
Hello.
A quick question or comment. Yes.
Yeah, I was going to ask your guest, because the first time I saw it on television when it happened, immediately I thought of, like, it's a controlled demolition, because I've seen those buildings in Las Vegas being put down, and it's so similar, the pattern. And then later on, I start telling people, you know, it's an inside job, it's a controlled demolition. Why is it that, well, my question is, did you have that in mind the first time you saw it on television like I did? And my second question is, why is it that a lot of people have a hard time, believing that their government can do this, or the American government can do this to their own people, or why is it that Americans is having a hard time believing that? I mean, why is they're in denial?
Right.
Thanks for your question, Roger.
Okay, I have to say that I did not get on this as quickly as you and a lot of other people did, but certainly. A lot of people who viewed that, who had seen controlled demolitions before, I frankly had not, so I'm a rather Johnny-come-lately to this. But Dan Rather on CBS that night, they played the video of Building 7 collapsing, and Dan comes right out and says, you know, that looks just like these buildings we've seen so many times that are brought down by explosives. And later on, while he was in England, he confessed that that he had been squelched, and that he and other news people were afraid to speak out in terms of what they knew. Now, as to why people can't believe this, I mean, the whole point of modern nationalism is to convince you to give your highest allegiance to your own nation. And so we grow up with this enormous amount of propaganda about how good and great our nation is. It's almost as if, unless you're willing to say America is the greatest nation on the face of the earth, you should go live somewhere else. I mean, that's sort of a national credo to be an American. And so we get all this rhetoric about how we have been going around the world promoting freedom and democracy and human rights. The reality, of course, for people who know the actual history of U.S. foreign policy and wars, is the exact opposite. As Noam Chomsky puts in the title of one of his books, Deterring Democracy. That's what U.S. foreign policy has basically been about for the last 60-some or even more years. But most people don't know this, and our news media are, you know, patriotic in this sense, and they continue to inculcate this idea that Americans, we may bumble here and there, and we may really screw up now and then, like with Katrina, but down deep we're good people who want to do good, and our political and military leaders simply wouldn't do anything really heinous.
David, we're going to have to stop it there, but I want to thank you very much for joining us today on Indie Media on Air.
Well, you're welcome. Okay. Glad to be with you.
Great. And for people who want to follow up, go to st911.org. Engineer today was D'Angelo Jones, and the producer was Alan Minsky. My name is Chris Burnett. You can reach me at chris@indiemedia.org for links and other information on this topic. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Indie Media on Air on the People's Radio Station, KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and streaming globally at kpfk.org. The Voices from the Frontline edition of the 4 O'Clock Report is coming up next. Stay tuned.
Looking for a show about politics and policy at the local, national, and international level? Want analysis with a Latino twist? Well, look no further. Tune in to Strategy Session with Antonio Gonzalez every Monday night at 8 p.m.
We seem to be in the midst of a polarization with a son or daughter of Prop 187 in process to be put on the ballot in California in November.
That's Strategy Session with Antonio Gonzalez, Mondays at 8 p.m. I'm in.